Next case for argument is Wachovia Bank versus Foster Bank. Mr. Parker.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Stan Parker, and I represent Foster Bank, the defendant and appellant in this case. Although this case actually involves a breach of warranty claim under the Uniform Commercial Code for breach of presentment warranties of a check, the critical issue in this case really concerns questions of burden of proof and evidence.
Mr. Parker, is
yes,
there
sir?
A final judgment in this case?
I believe there is, sir.
How much have you been ordered to pay Wachovia?
I don't recall the exact figure, but it was
the
in
the reason
order.
Why you don't recall the exact figure is that, so far as I can tell, you haven't been ordered to pay them anything. The only document I can find in this record is one saying, quote, "It is therefore ordered and adjudged that summary judgment is granted," close quote. But that's not a final judgment. For a final judgment, we need an order to pay money. Now, what the district court's opinion said is that Wachovia is entitled to recover the face value of the check, which is about $133,000, plus appropriate interest, less any reimbursement owed to it from Media Edge. Has the district court ever quantified the amount of prejudgment interest or reimbursement owed from Media Edge?
No, Your Honor, at this point.
Well, then
not.
We don't have a final judgment.
That issue was
That's
actually
pretty
raised.
Straightforward.
Was raised by this court earlier, and the court requested briefs on the jurisdictional question of whether there was a final judgment. Those briefs were submitted. I'm not aware of any specific decision
and
by this court. However,
just,
it was
it's
set
just
for
canonical order. That if a party is entitled to prejudgment interest, there is no final judgment until that amount has been quantified. There's nothing purporting to be a final judgment in this case, so far as I can see. There's just this thing saying summary judgment is granted. That's a procedural step, not a judgment.
There was also an entry of judgment filed, and this, I believe, was brought initially as a declaratory judgment action, requesting
well,
an order declaring
that... If you
seek
a declaratory judgment, then the suit ends when a declaratory judgment is entered. But
and
the
that
statement,
declaration...
No. The statement, summary judgment is entered, is not a declaratory judgment. A declaratory judgment declares relief.
You referred to briefs on the jurisdictional issue. I don't have any briefs. Something beyond the jurisdictional statements?
Of course,
yes,
the jurisdictional statement in your brief pays no heed to this at all. Nor does the jurisdictional statement in the appellee's brief.
That is correct. Subsequent to the filing of these briefs,
right,
we received an order requesting basically a show-cause order why this should not be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
Mm.
And it's those briefs that we
so
filed.
So you submitted something.
Yes, sir.
We don't have them. Do you have them?
I don't have them. I have something about the Rule 60A motion, which I think was about parties, but I don't have briefs on the finality issue.
Mm.
Do you recall writing a brief on the
yes.
finality?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
Okay.
And
we'll
if you did that, why did you ignore the issue in your jurisdictional statement? Your jurisdictional statement doesn't even refer to any separate filings.
Well, he said he filed it later.
That was subsequent, Your Honor. Subsequent to the filing of these briefs on appeal, in response to an order from this court.
This court doesn't enter post-briefing orders unknown to the merits panel.
Apparently
once the briefs have been filed, only the merits panel issues such orders. And this is complete weirdness.
Well, why don't you and your opponent resubmit those post-brief briefs in case we can't find them in our own records?
Yes, we will
okay.
do so.
So you can go ahead with your argument.
The case turns on questions of burden
Except
of proof and evidence.
Speaking of missing links, what do you think? How do you think the payee's name was altered?
That's not known.
Well, if it's not known, what? Well, suppose it was altered in the old-fashioned way, you know, whited out Media Enterprises and wrote in Troy or whatever it was. So in that case, clearly, clearly you'd be liable.
If it was the original check,
right,
as altered, that was presented.
Look, that's what I'm saying, right?
Yes.
The old-fashioned
Correct.
Way, original check, you scratch out the payee's name, put another name. So your argument really is that if it was not done that way, but if instead it was a counterfeited new check, then the theory behind the allocation of liability between the two banks would fail. That's fine. But now, so what's the evidence?
That's our primary point, Your Honor.
But your argument means essentially that Congress shouldn't have bothered to pass the statute allowing banks to rely on computer copies, essentially, of checks, because this will come up in every single altered payee case under modern standards. I don't frankly see any difference from a policy point of view between an alteration of the payee in the old-fashioned way and an alteration of the payee if somebody scans it into a computer and puts a different payee name in and generates a new check, as long as two checks aren't presented. Now, there's no question that two checks were not presented to Media Edge. There's an altered payee somehow or another, but why isn't that the essence of this, that the payee name is that which is crucial?
You may be correct that this will require legislation. This may be a case where the technology, of course, advances ahead of the law.
Well, there's no way, under your theory, you just can't use computers for this.
That's not correct at all.
No computer will ever have the little microscopic paper fibers and the evidence of whiteout or what have you. It will never happen on a computer.
That part of it is true.
And how would your client gain from a rule that said your bank, just like Wachovia, has to maintain the paper copies? Your client is going to be on one side of this dispute just as often as it's on the other.
That also is true.
So far as I can see, in order to save $133,000 less reimbursement from Media Edge, you're willing to impose on your client a very substantial ongoing economic cost of maintaining paper copies.
Your Honor, that ultimately would be a business decision. Banks are charged with the knowledge of their customer signatures.
No, it's a policy decision for the entire
economy. That is
true. That's Judge Easterbrook's point.
That is true.
Every single bank in the United States would have to keep all of these paper copies.
Just like banks are required to know their customer signatures, as a practical matter, they don't look at them.
Computers.
Mr. Parker, I've just looked at our online docket. No jurisdictional statements were filed in this case after the filing of the briefs. There was a motion for a limited remand under Rule 60A. There have been no filings from the parties about whether there was a final judgment. They are not in our online, they're not in our docket. They're not in our online filing system. They just don't exist.
Your Honor, I would be happy when I get back to the office to look for our copy of it. This was during the time that we were going through the mandatory settlement conference.
That is before briefing in this circuit. There's no settlement conference after briefing. You're completely pulling our leg.
Well, don't say that. We don't know what the fact is. So it isn't clear to me that you need paper copies. Suppose Troy had. Did Troy have any other of these altered checks?
There's nothing in this record about that one way or the other, Your Honor.
Have you investigated to see whether you could prove the nature of this alteration even without the copy of the check? Maybe the FBI knows something about how people alter checks nowadays. Maybe nobody whites out the payee's name. Maybe it's so easy to forge a check that's the mode of alteration. Then maybe a court could infer that that's how this probably was altered. But there hasn't been any factual investigation by you, has there been?
No, Your Honor. We did request the original item from Wachovia, and of course it was
not
available.
But that's where you stopped. That's where you stopped. You didn't make any effort to show that this was altered in such an modern way that the alteration rule just shouldn't be applied.
Well, Your Honor, although not in the record at that point in time, Ms. Choi had withdrawn most of the money and
decamped.
Yes, absconded, vanished, whatever.
Well, did you look for her?
I am told that the bank looked for her, yes. I personally did not.
But what about is there a literature on this, on modern bank fraud or something like that, and talks about how people alter? Right, it's a kind of arms race. The better the banks are at detecting alteration in the old-fashioned way, the more the thieves will look for alternative methods. So is there some literature on that? We could learn about how likely it was? Suppose the FBI said all alterations today are made by forging the check. Nobody is dumb enough to try to scratch out a payee's name.
They may not
unless
scratch it out,
unless the payee and the fraud's name differ by one letter or something. But here, of course, they're completely different names.
Again, outside the record, there are still many instances of chemical washing of a check where it is the original document and they've removed the ink and retyped ways that obviously are much less obvious than using Whiteout.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Parker. Mr. Lewis?
Mr. Parker, by the way, I've now found a pre-briefing jurisdictional statement. Is that what you're referring to?
It may be, Your Honor. My recollection is simply that we received an order from the court.
Yes, there was one on the docket before briefing.
Okay.
And, of course, that leaves my question, why your brief paid no attention to it?
Because it was addressed in those briefs and the appeal moved forward.
Well, maybe Mr. Lewis can cast some light on this. Can you?
I may be able to, Your Honor. Good morning, and counsel. May it please the court. This suit was brought as a declaratory judgment action because the underlying customer, Media Edge, has a lawsuit pending in New York that has been stayed pending this suit. We have not yet paid the $133,036 to Media Edge. Instead, we sought in this lawsuit merely a declaratory judgment as to which of us, Foster Bank or Wachovia, is going to be responsible ultimately for reimbursing the customer. The customer has been willing to wait. So we felt when we got the judgment from we're concerned about this. It's not our appeal, of course, but we're concerned about having an enforceable judgment. We thought that the judgment that we had from Judge Holderman was sufficient. It says judgment is entered for Wachovia, summary judgment is entered. It says
summary judgment is not a judgment. A judgment has to indicate the relief to which the prevailing party is entitled.
We believe,
and this document does not provide for any relief to anyone about anything.
Well, it says judgment is entered, not
it
just
says judgment is entered in the second to last sentence of the order, and I believe the memorandum of opinion in the last paragraph talks about what those amounts might be. 133 up to the full amount of the check plus any interest.
Plus
less
interest. And as I say, it's canonical that if a party is entitled to interest, that has to be quantified.
Again, this is a declaratory judgment. We only sought a declaration as to which of us is responsible. If the final judgment as amended is not a final judgment, in fact, that raises concerns for us, and we'd be pleased to go back to the district court to get that amended to conform this into a final order that we can enforce and that can be a final judgment.
So you envision this as being some declaration from the district court that just says Wachovia doesn't owe Foster anything?
Wachovia doesn't owe Media Edge anything. That's correct.
Well, no. Media Edge wasn't a party to this suit. This is a suit between Wachovia and Foster.
No, as between the two banks.
So
if we pay our customer, Foster is responsible for reimbursing us for those amounts. That's correct. With interest, we sought attorney's fees. That was denied.
Okay.
On the merits of the case, the sole issue in this appeal is whether Foster Bank's breach of presentment warranty under the UCC was properly established on summary judgment through submission of a true and correct copy of the deposited item when the original item had been destroyed in the ordinary course of business and in good faith. There's no dispute that Wachovia, which is seeking to enforce Foster's presentment warranty here, destroyed the original item prior to anyone learning that there had been an alteration, and consistent with its ordinary business practices, which, by the way, are common in this industry to avoid theft of originals, to avoid unnecessary warehousing costs. Wachovia used that copy, along with a true and correct copy of the item as originally drawn by its customer, to establish that Foster had breached its presentment warranty. This was an altered item. The original drawn item and the true and correct copy of the deposited altered item were identical in all material respects. The media
edge banner. But now, suppose it's the case, actually, Mr. Parker said it wasn't, but suppose the case that nowadays all checks are altered by forging a new check. Would this presentment warranty make any sense?
Actually, the last part of our brief addresses that scenario. We think that the alteration scenario, even if they had elicited some proof that this was a copy of the original rather than the original that was deposited, even if they had elicited that proof, the presentment warranties under the alteration rules would still apply, because they, as the depositor bank, would have been the bank with the best opportunity under the UCC policy.
But what would their opportunity be? Well, it seems to me neither party would have a better opportunity than the other.
Well, it would be sort of a hybrid scenario. Counterfeit and forgery, the bellwether of those kinds of cases, are the forged drawer signatures, where someone copies a check, forges Media Edge's signature, and then deposits it, and the payor bank pays.
But that's more or less what you'd have. If somebody scanned the original Media Edge check payable to CMP into their computer, and then changed the line and made it say payable to Ms. Choi, and then generated a new check, the signature on that check is effectively a forged signature.
Even though
it looks exactly the same because of digital technology, that's a forged check.
That's right. But it's also an altered payee check. So it would be this sort of hybrid where she completed her copying and duplication on a real check that had been signed and authorized by Media Edge originally. She completed her fraud solely by altering the payee. Which bank should honor its presentment warranty? Which bank's presentment warranty is required to be honored in that case? We would think it would be the depositor banks.
I don't see how Foster Bank would have any way of knowing that there was anything irregular about that. It has no reason to question its customer when she presents a check payable to her drawn on some other bank.
Well, it would still be an altered payee. It would still be the original.
I know the payee's been altered, but how is Foster supposed to? I mean, if there's been something physical done to the check in the good old days, then maybe Foster would be in a position to see something fishy about it. But in this instance, why are they a good risk bearer?
Well, all of this, of course, is a diversion from their lack of evidence. I mean, the presumption is that there is no other means of altering a check other than copying and computer duplication and the like.
Are you aware of any ferment in banking law circles about the impact of the elimination of the paper copies on these traditional?
Absolutely.
The UCC rules. Is something being discussed.
The UCC was revised in 1990 to allow for check transfer.
No, I understand it's perfectly proper, but have the implications of this for the traditional allocation of liabilities between the drawer bank?
To some extent. There's a UCC section 4406B. This is not an issue as between depositor bank and payor bank, but in that case, a payor bank under 4406B, as against its customer, is entitled to keep digital copies as opposed to
right,
originals.
We know that. But I guess what I'm wondering as we sit here and look at this is, I mean, the banks were all very gung-ho for this get rid of the paper copy thing, and they were thinking of all the money they were going to save by having the digital copies. And now it appears that maybe there's a cost on the other side of that equation from the failure to be able to detect certain types of frauds as effectively as was possible in the old world. And I just wonder if the trade-off is so overwhelmingly favorable on the cost-saving side that people would say, well, so be it, every now and then we'll lose $133,000, or whether, in fact, there's rethinking of whether that trade-off has been properly drawn.
I'm not aware of anyone regretting moving to duplication digital duplication. In fact, Congress in the Check 21 Act just a couple of years ago codified existing law
and
said a substitute check shall be the legal equivalent
and
for all
purposes.
And one
wonders, Congress doesn't always know everything. so that's why I'm asking.
Appreciate that. I believe that the rules of evidence as well as the UCC citations that I've mentioned as well as the Check 21 Act all lead to the conclusion that duplicates are as good as originals. And certainly they are in the absence of any genuine issue, any proof whatsoever that they might have submitted, as Your Honor was discussing with counsel. They could have talked to Ms. Choi. They had fraud investigators that went through the several checks that she wrote that were frauds, apparently, including ours. No one came forward with an affidavit saying that part of her fraud included copying the original item and then depositing the copy.
Does the record show anything about who Ms. Choi is? I just have the feeling this is probably a bit off the point. If I showed up at my bank with a check for $133,026, they might wonder, you know, why I was walking in with a check like that. But if she runs a business or, I mean, if she's got some reason to handle amounts of money like that, surely it's Foster Bank who would know that, not Wachovia.
That's exactly right. We don't know who she was. We do know that the Foster Bank did try to sue her in state court to pursue reimbursement of this check and others. We've been told, I believe, off the record that she may have been a business customer, but we have no idea.
Wasn't she originally sued as a third-party defendant in this case?
She was.
Well, why was she dismissed?
I believe the state, the court below withdrew jurisdiction of that claim because it was a state court claim. The citizens...
But why? In a defendant in a federal lawsuit is entitled to implead a third party who may be liable to it. And it looked, you know, since Foster Bank is liable to Wachovia, like her liability to Foster Bank would now be determined. I can't see why it was dismissed.
The dismissal may have been because she was never served. As I recall, the service was never perfected. It may be because they believed that state law rules might prevail.
Failure to perfect service is a good reason for dismissal.
Well, she's vanished, hasn't she?
As far as we know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Gillis. So, Mr. Parker, we'll give you a minute if you have anything further.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As to your last question, that's absolutely correct. We were not able to find her in
the
service.
So do you, like Mr. Lewis, do you interpret this judgment of Judge Holderman's as a declaratory judgment?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the argument that Foster had the obligation to come forward with some evidence that this was counterfeit as opposed to an original check, that is, in our opinion, one of the key issues.
But there's no doubt whatsoever on this record that there's an altered payee. There's no doubt that Media Edge issued a check drawn on Wachovia Bank in a certain amount, the check with a certain number signed by the Media Edge person authorized to do that sort of thing. The really only issue that you're presenting is whether it matters how the payee was altered. And there, you know, maybe the UCC isn't quite up to date, but surely the policy reasons for the present allocation of responsibility still hold. Because, as I said, it's really Foster who's going to know if Choi is showing up every day with checks that look pretty big for at least an individual.
That is true, but it is Wachovia that will know what its customers' checks, what security features they may have. We're talking about physical characteristics of that.
No, we're also talking about who is in a better position to detect altered payee. And if somebody comes and presents a check and it's wildly out of line with the normal transactions that person has, it's going to be that person's bank in a position to detect that.
In terms of an out-of-the-ordinary deposit, that is true. Again, off the record, she and her husband did operate a business, I'm told, and had more than one account with this bank. But beyond that, the current state of the law is that if that document that was presented to Foster was the original check, then they breached the warranty. If it was not the same physical piece of paper, then they did not breach the warranty. Okay. Absent that piece of paper or some testimony from someone who saw it, as opposed to seeing copies of it, our position is that they have no evidence to sustain their burden to establish one of the elements of their claim that we breached our warranty.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Parker and Mr. Lewis. Next case.